What if Joe Biden didn't hop on a plane and run out of New Hampshire and fly away like brave Sir Robin, brave Sir Robin? What if he walked to South Carolina after he got his butt kicked in New Hampshire? You know what people would be saying?
Dead man! Dead man walking! Dead man walking here! Dead man! We got a dead man walking here! Dead man walking! We got a dead man walking!
Biden isn't dead, not really. He's just in a political repose, like an elderly gent sitting alone in a diner in Florida, glad his teeth fit. The other tables around him are empty, and he's just eating the Jell-O, and you can hear the spoon clicking on his teeth. And he's thinking, what about watching Wheel of Fortune and getting to bed by 7? It's over for you, Joe. It's done. I think it started and ended with that lying dog-faced pony soldier thing. You don't call young women lying dog-faced pony soldiers and then blame it on Tyrone Power or John Wayne because they don't know who you're talking about.
So how do you explain the performance in Iowa, and why should the voters believe that you can win the national election?
It's a good question. Number one, Iowa's a Democratic caucus. You ever been to a caucus? No, you haven't. You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier. You said you were, but now you got to be honest. I'm going to be honest with you.
It's over, Elizabeth Warren. Amy Klobuchar took your voters. Make some Native American food, maybe omelets with cold crab meat. Did you think that making yourself out to be a Native American and climbing up the political ladder wouldn't backfire? Of course it would. And Bernie Sanders is the man on the left wing of the party of the left wing. The Democratic establishment is terrified of Bernie. That's why Mike, throw him up against the wall, Bloomberg is there, spending $300 million already and spending more in South Carolina Super Tuesday. The Democrats are in disarray, but the Republicans were in disarray in 2016, and all the common wisdom said that Trump could never win. And now it's Bernie's turn. This is the difficult part for people who cleave to candidates, who believe in them, who identify with them, and think they're virtuous champions of truth. We should all congratulate the people who joined up with candidates. I'm talking about you, people out there, voters. You like a certain candidate, you don't like another, you join, you buy the button, you go to the rallies, you believe. I appreciate that, and I think all Americans should salute you. But the spinners don't believe in virtue. The guys who buy the advertising on TV and get 10% of every ad buy that their candidate gets, puts that in their pocket, they don't believe in virtue. Politics is all about who gets what and how much, and deserves, like Clint Eastwood said in The Unforgiven, have got nothing to do with it. Mayor Pete or Wall Street Pete, I don't know how a white gay man will do with fundamentalist Christian African-American voters in South Carolina. I don't know. Media's having a hard time even formulating the question. But he's in the middle lane, along with Bloomberg and Amy Klobuchar. And I think Amy Klobuchar has the personality and the persona to beat Donald Trump. But will she have the money? We'll talk about all this with Tom Bevin, president and co-founder of Real Clear Politics, the great website of Balanced Opinion. Tom Bevin is the best political analyst in the country, period. WGN Radio's Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer of The Rokan Show. As always, co-host and my friend, the master of sound. And my wife Betty really likes it when Jeff gets a word in, because there's a big mouth talking too much. And that big mouth is me, John Cass, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, a member of that newspaper's editorial board. And where are you as Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren scuff their heels, shuffling on that boulevard of broken dreams? Where are you? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN+.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
And as I promised, we're talking to Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics. You see him on TV giving his opinion and analysis. And you know why? Because he's the best analyst politically in the country. Okay,
that's awfully kind of you, John.
Well, you know, it's not that you're not one of these personalities, these TV personalities that they pay a lot of money to, and then they got to have them sitting up there on their panel. You know, to promote them. You're just a guy with information.
I wish they would pay me a lot of money to sit up there on the panel and pontificate.
What did Samuel Johnson say? A writer who doesn't write for money is a jackass. Anyway.
Yes.
So, Tom, I haven't seen The Green Mile in a long time, but I was thinking of it. You know, dead man walking to Carolina, to South Carolina. How's Joe Biden? And what did you think of that whole mess?
That is actually how I described him last night. I was on the aforementioned TV show, and I said he is a political dead man walking. I don't think we've ever seen a candidate for president finish as poorly as he has done in the first two states and go on to win the nomination. It would require a remarkable turnaround for Joe Biden. Now, anything's possible, and certainly this field makes it, you know, possible that he could hold on to the African-American vote, but I just don't see it happening. I mean, if you look at the 8 days that took place between Iowa and New Hampshire and the narrative and, you know, how bad it was for him, and he gets up on the debate stage and he's like, yeah, we took a gut punch in Iowa and we're probably going to take another one here. I mean, it was just, and then to leave the state and basically wave the white flag. There are 18 days, 2.5 weeks now between now and South Carolina. And you can just imagine he's already lost his lead in the national polls. He's ahead in Nevada, but only by 3.5 points to Sanders. You can be assured that that's going to switch as Buttigieg and Klobuchar pick up some momentum and rise in these polls. And then you look to South Carolina. He's ahead by about 13 points in our average. We'll get some fresh data out of there. We've already seen some signs that his support among African Americans is eroding, migrating to other supporters and or other candidates. And I think this is only going to accelerate the idea that this was the guy who was supposed to be able to be, you know, Mr. Electable, and he's going to save the country from Trump, and he can't even beat, you know, a socialist who's not even a Democrat and the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's finishing behind Elizabeth Warren. It's just...
Yes, and Mayor Pete is a man who is a person who actually impersonates a human being. He's actually... I've heard Dan Prof call him the a mannequin from the men's department at Macy's in Mishawaka.
Yeah.
Mayor Pete has perfected the art of saying nothing earnestly.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
Yes and no. I do think, look, I saw Mayor Pete in an event in Iowa, and if you listen to him, he is good. It was a town hall, and he's very good at couching his language and framing the issues around values and faith and small town and, you know, that kind of stuff, and right. Which resonated with folks in Iowa clearly, and he got some of that in New Hampshire as well. So it's maybe less about the substance of what he's saying, but it's the way he's saying it.
Of course.
It sounds a little bit, certainly sounds a little different than Sanders, who's preaching revolution, right?
He's the Obama. He's an Obama type. He's an empty vessel. The kind of candidate David Axelrod loves. you take someone that people really don't know, and you can project all your, you know, I want to be Trump. I'm anxious about the left. I just feel good when you're talking. I'm in the suburbs. I'm with female in the suburbs, and I want to vote for somebody. All those things, he just kind of soaks that up, doesn't he?
Yes, and there's a market for that in this you know, current political environment, because A, folks do want to beat Trump, number one, and he's preaching this unity and this, you know, forward looking vision of what the country's going to look like the day after Trump is defeated and the sun's rising over the, you know, like all that stuff. And it is very Obama-esque, but it seems to be working. And meanwhile, Biden, who was sort of promising a return to the past, really, of the good old days of Obama, has, you know, we had speculated for months whether this guy had a glass jaw and whether past performance was an indicator of future results. And sure enough, it's exactly how this has played out. And I think, you know, he may not even make it to South Carolina. This thing could go south on him really, really rapidly. Funders could shut off the money, you know, and we've already seen stories, people leaking out, you know, anonymous quotes from inside the campaign about how panicked they are. So I think Biden's in really bad shape.
Yeah, and he was probably in South Carolina before midnight almost. I mean, it seemed he was out of there in a hurry. Tom, I got to ask, you watch this stuff and you're on it all the time, but have you seen Mayor Pete nonplussed in anything? I haven't seen him like rattled yet. And you've seen it with Biden. You've seen it with Warren. You've seen, I mean, all of them. Someone gets them on something that's counterance or has to force them into something. Klobuchar even, you know, they all seem to have these moments where you can actually see on video where their brains are like, I don't have this one stored. Yeah, I don't have this one stored away. Whereas Mayor Pete, I haven't seen yet. And maybe I've missed it, but he just doesn't seem, nobody seems to have gotten him on something yet where he was like, you know, that kind of moment. Have you seen that?
I haven't. And he is very, I mean, look, he's very good on his feet. And I, quite frankly, I thought, and this wasn't spontaneous, it was obviously rehearsed, but I thought his response to Biden's attack on him that he wasn't the new Obama was handled very well. I mean, he said, look, I'm not Obama and neither are you. And this isn't 2008. I mean, I thought that was a very, very effective, well-delivered rebuttal to this last-ditch attack by Joe Biden. And you're right. I mean, he seems to be able to handle all of these questions. He seems to be pretty calm and collected, as you know, calm and collected is the favorable euphemism, or as John would say, robotic, like it's already pre-programmed in there. But he hasn't had an oops moment for sure.
He did have a little bit of a deer in the headlights when Amy Klobuchar turned on him, but he's the beneficiary of not having, you know, humans have pores.
Well, so but yeah,
he has no pores, so he's not.
He did not have the Rubio response. If she was playing Chris Christie and he was playing the role of Marco Rubio, he did not. He responded much better than Rubio did back in the 2016 campaign.
What's your assessment of the media, particularly television? I'm thinking of CNN. You know, starting off with their hit pieces on Bernie. You know, on that fake Liz Warren nonsense, where Bernie. You called me a liar on national TV and all that stuff, and then all their talking heads went and buttressed that argument. And then later MSNBC, which skews farther to the left and more conspiratorial, if possible.
Wait, what?
Just kidding. MSNBC, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you hear things from Chris Matthews that Bernie Sanders will execute him in the public square. And bring back the gulags. What do you make of how that kind of coverage backfired? Did it?
We actually have a clip on our site from Ari Melber, who does is a host of an MSNBC show, and he's a lawyer and progressive guy, and he was in a diner in New Hampshire, and one of the women there said,
I want to say the reason I went for Bernie is because of MSNBC. And
go on.
I think it is completely cynical to say that he's lost 50% of his vote from the last time when there were two candidates. Now there are multiple wonderful candidates who would be great presidents and people that we could, I think, that we can unify and get behind. But the kind of the stop Bernie cynicism that I heard from a number of people, I watch MSNBC constantly, so I heard that from a number of commentators, and so that just, it made me angry enough. I said, okay, Bernie's got my vote.
This is such an interesting point. What you're saying is, and we take criticism because we're journalists, right? We got to be open-minded. You're saying that hearing from people, whether it's guests, contributors, the conversations you've heard that you felt were designed to tear down Senator Sanders or quote-unquote stop him, actually endeared him to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I could have chosen several candidates, but that's what pushed me over the edge for Bernie.
That's really interesting, and thank you for sharing it.
Which I thought was kind of revealing, and I think MSNBC has had that, and certainly CNN. CNN has been, of all the networks, absolutely disgraceful in the way that they've not only handled Bernie, but you look at this stuff with Tulsi Gabbard. They did two full nights of town halls leading up to the New Hampshire primary, and they gave town halls to all the front runners, obviously all the top tier candidates, but they excluded her, didn't even give her an explanation as to why she was not receiving a town hall, and gave town halls to Deval Patrick, who was polling at 0.4%, okay, and Tom Steyer, who was polling below her in New Hampshire. He's polling above her in some of these other states, and he's obviously a billionaire and spent tons more money than her. But there's really no excuse for that. And so they've gone out of their way to sort of manipulate the process and put their thumb on the scales of the people who they think voters should hear from and how they should hear from them. So I think CNN's been the worst offender in that regard. Part of the problem that the Democrats are facing, obviously, John, is that they've got, you know, they've got four or five candidates that, I mean, after New Hampshire, the field winnowed by two, Andrew Yang and Michael Bennett, which totaled about, 3.3% of the vote. Everybody else has given indications, at least as of right now, that they're staying in. Now, maybe Warren will reconsider at some point. Maybe Biden will reconsider before. But, I mean, he seems like he's going to stick into South Carolina. And Warren, you know, while she really doesn't have a path now, she still has money. She still has some support. And we'll see, you know, how this plays out. But this could be a slog for some time, at least through Super Tuesday, until somebody takes a hold of this nomination. Meanwhile, you know, you've got Michael Bloomberg waiting in the wings, who's spending tons of money. He took a big hit the other day with these stop and frisk audio tapes that came out. But he's going to be added to the mix here very, very shortly. And so it's a bit of a mess right now.
And Tom, I got to tell you, after the debacle in Iowa, and then now we're in New Hampshire, and you've got the Buttigieg up and Sanders up. Among liberal people, younger demographic, I mean, I'm a little younger, and my fiance is younger, and still, they see as it's over. Like they said, after that mess up, after these mixed messages, this far left, middle left, who knows what kind of mentality from the candidates in the field, they're apathetic about all of it. I see this, and they're not alone. Like even my mom, who is a conservative, who can't stand Trump as a person, you know, was looking for a Democrat to vote for, but now after all this, the messages they're putting out there, she's got no appetite for any of them, and it seems like the wind, if there was any, is out of their sails, and there's no way they can overcome this machine that Trump has, because he's been oiled up and running for this for 3 years.
Well, it's certainly true that the Democrats went from, you know, having really high hopes and high expectations to Iowa was very much a gut punch for the party's morale. You know, they couldn't count the votes. The turnout was down. You know, meanwhile, Trump had a great week, and suddenly everything sort of flipped around. Now, turnout in New Hampshire was good. On the Democratic side, it was at 2008 levels, so, you know, Barack Obama levels, which was good. Now, to your point, though, Trump won more votes last night in New Hampshire than any previous sitting president running for re-election. He beat Obama in 2012, he doubled him up. So clearly there's enthusiasm on the Republican side now in a way that, you know, and to your point, Trump's got tons of money. He's got volunteers, you know, on the ground in 19 states, and they are working hard to make sure that you know his incumbency is leveraged for all that it's worth in this coming battle. And the question for Democrats is whether they can find somebody who's going to unite the party and, you know, re-energize them come November. And I just don't see it, because every one of these candidates, whoever's the nominee, somebody's going to have hurt feelings. Somebody's going to stay home. So they're not going to please everybody. And that's going to be a problem, because every vote is going to count, especially in these battleground states where it could be decided by a few thousand votes one way or the other. I mean, if you get a, you know, somebody who's not Bernie Sanders and the Bernie bros stay home, or if you get Bernie Sanders and then you get some of the moderates who stay home, it's going to be a real problem for them.
The moderates won't stay home. They hate Trump, and so will the Bernie bros will come out. I think, in my view, that they do have a candidate that could beat Trump. But
let me guess.
You want to guess?
Does her first initial start with M and her last name rhymes with your mama? No?
I wasn't thinking of that, but you know, I was thinking more of that Veep show, you know? That character on Veep that ate her salad with a comb.
Right.
Which would be Amy Klobuchar.
Amy Klobuchar.
But you brought, you know, Tom Bevin is the one who got me in trouble by forcing me to run for mayor of Chicago.
I know.
And then not only that, you also predicted, I think, am I on the Chicago way, that Michelle would come to the rescue as Warrior Queen Boudica of the Celts on some kind of chariot and save the Democratic Party. Yes?
I did say that the day after 2016. Look, I don't know how this is going to work out. I think the odds of a contested convention are growing, continue to grow steadily. But Michelle Obama, you know, or Oprah or Mark Cuban or somebody, I mean, I guess it's possible, but it still seems unlikely at this point. And Amy Klobuchar, let's talk about her for a minute since you brought her up.
Yeah, I think she can do it. I think she can. If she had the money.
Hold on a second. Let's discuss this for a second.
If she had the money.
So Amy Klobuchar is in Nowheresville in Nevada, okay, which is 11 days away. She is currently in our average at 3%. We only have two polls in the average because we don't have a lot of data there. But one poll has her at 2%. One poll has her at 4%. And both of these polls were taken in the middle of January. Okay, Buttigieg is a little bit better. He's at 7%. So he's got a 4-point lead on her starting out. Biden's at 21. That's going to change, as I mentioned. And then you look at South Carolina. Again, this is a state. We don't have a lot of data. But Klobuchar's at 2%. Buttigieg is at 5.5. At some point, if Amy Klobuchar is going to be the nominee of the party, she's going to have to beat Pete Buttigieg in some states. She's going to have to beat him. And, you know, she's starting from scratch in Nevada. She has no presence there whatsoever. She's got no presence in South Carolina. So maybe she can beat him in South Carolina if she picks up the black vote and he doesn't. But at some point, she's got to beat him or he's going to be the nominee. And then you take it one step further. I mean, at some point, Buttigieg has got to start beating Bernie Sanders in the popular vote. He can't finish second to him all the way through and expect that he's going to end up being the nominee either. So there's a problem for some of these candidates. Even Klobuchar she's definitely going to get lift out of this. She's going to get a windfall of money, and she's going to have to turn around and plow it right back into these states and try and go from 0 to 60. But I'm not sure where this leads her in the end. Explain to me how you think she's going to win the nomination.
You just kind of ruined it, but you gave me a good column idea. As a conservative, I'm thinking about, I'm trying to be, have the, you know, mindset of the liberal looking for the savior or savioress. And maybe she's not it, but I thought she did a good job in the debate. And I think that in a one-on-one, you know, that type of personality would bode to do well against Donald Trump. But
I agree with both of those things. She did have a good debate. She definitely reaped some of the rewards from that. And she would be tough for Donald Trump in some of these, you know, Midwestern states if they can just get there. But, you know, in order for her to get there, you'd need Biden to drop out, probably, and you'd probably need Buttigieg to drop. Why would Buttigieg drop out and clear the way for her?
You know, one thing I've noticed, maybe I've missed it, but I've seen a reticence among some of the pundits, many of the pundits, to talk about Buttigieg's challenges as a white, gay Democrat running in South Carolina, seeking black votes. Black people are, African Americans in the South are generally super Christian and fundamentalist and very conservative in their social views. How's that going to work? Now, I know that Lori Lightfoot, who I backed in Chicago, overcame all that with black voters, but she herself was black.
Right.
On the intersectionality highway, are journalists also worried about crashing and burning?
I think so. I mean, I think, look, and it's a generational thing. I don't think I think older voters in particular and older African-American voters, you're right, are going to, you know, he's probably not going to do as well with those folks because of their religious beliefs and whatnot. Maybe he won't have that same issue with some of the younger voters. But it's a factor. It's one that people haven't really talked about. And the media, it's a bit of an intersectionality car crash if you have black voters end up, you know, denying the Buttigieg nomination because potentially as one factor involved is his, sexual preference. It's going to get messy. It's going to get messy. But we don't know, you know, how this is all going to play out. I mean, I do think once Biden, the other thing that voters really want, as we've talked about before, they want to beat Trump and they want to be with a winner. And Sanders and Buttigieg right now are the two guys who've proven that they have overperformed. At least Buttigieg has overperformed and come close to winning a couple of states. And that's going to be alluring to some voters in all of these states, including African-American voters, who are going to say, you know what, I think he might be the guy who can take on Donald Trump. His age might be more of a factor for some of these folks, too, because they look at him and it's not necessarily that he's gay. It's that he's young. It's that he's inexperienced. And they look at Trump and they're like, wow. You know, Trump's going to eat this kid alive.
Common wisdom is often wrong, as we proved in 2016. I'd suggest something here, Mr. Bevin. I'd like you and Jeff to weigh in.
Okay.
The contribution of Andrew Yang was significant, even though he's gone, because he expressed the kind of underlying emotional zeitgeist of the electorate in this way. We're going through, America and the world is going to go through a tremendous economic change, greater than the Industrial Revolution. People will be out of jobs, truck drivers will, you know, the low-skill workers, robots, you know, the rap on that. And so that uncertainty, particularly among the young who want their college tuitions, the college loan debt wiped out, will be attractive. And so I'm not necessarily convinced that Trump trounces Sanders if Sanders wins the nomination. Because I think that this uncertainty in the culture, even though the economy is good, is going to drive votes. Yes or no? You can say yeah, no. We're friends. I mean, you could say, John, you're a nutball. This is not going to happen.
So I'm of two minds about this. I mean, I guess I can argue it both ways because I agree with this. I mean, look, it is the driving, animating feature of our politics and really has been, whether we recognize it or not, since the Great Recession of 2008, right? This dislocation of Main Street from the elites and from Wall Street and the like. And Andrew Yang definitely spoke to that. I mean, I liked Andrew Yang because I just thought he was a fun guy. I mean, he seemed like he was having fun. He was enjoying himself. He was honest and spontaneous and in a way that most politicians aren't. And even though if you didn't agree with his main platform, this universal basic income, I thought he was pretty effective at arguing, to your point, about, you know, the humanity and the family and all these things. And that's, you know, look, Trump's not the root of all of our problems and all of that. So I can see how Sanders would be competitive with Trump because he's this other side of the populist coin, right? He's approaching it from the other side. Trump's argument was, look, you've got the elites have been screwing you guys, right? It's been this unholy alliance between the elites in Washington and the, you know, corporatists, and there's crony capitalism and all that. And Bernie Sanders is basically saying the same thing from the other side, which is it's top 1% screwing everybody. And, you know, 99% is a big, you know, it's the Walton family and pharma and all that stuff. So this message is there's a lot of overlap there. On the other hand, Gallup came out with a poll just a few days ago showing the, you know, whether when voters say they would have no problem voting for, and they listed a whole bunch of things. If someone who's black, who's a woman, who's Catholic, who's Jewish, who's gay, who's whatever. And the only one that polled below 50%, meaning only 45% of people said they would have no problem voting for a socialist. It was the last on the list. So it is. And I do think there was just a story, for one example, John, of how Democrats in southern Florida, in the Miami area, are contemplating what life would be like for them with Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket. And they've got all these, like, they've got all these Cuban American, you know, folks. They've got all these immigrants from South America, from Venezuela, from a lot of these communist, you know, socialist countries that have seen what it does and basically fled it for America. And I do think there would be, you know, Trump has to win Florida, obviously, but I do think there would be, Trump would be able to make a real case against Sanders in a way that he wouldn't be able to make against Amy Klobuchar or some of these other folks. And I could argue that might be an effective case, and it might really lead to, you know, a potential race that's not very close if Bernie Sanders can't articulately defend himself against those attacks, then it could get away from him quickly.
And I counter to all that saying that nobody's going to beat Donald Trump, only because, and I don't know if you guys follow the show at all, but I love The Circus on Showtime. Mark McKinnon, John Heilman, I know I'd take him or leave him, but McKinnon is my favorite on that. Anyway, they all did this tape of Iowa and behind the scenes, and there was a scene where at a Trump rally where you have all the rock stars of the impeachment that were there, who were towing the line, who were able to fire up people who were on national TV every day because the Democrats pushed this crap through. And they were, everybody loved them. And they were like, oh my God, I want to get a picture, you know, with Meadows, or I want to get a picture with Mnuchin. Like, I mean, there's no way that machine is going to be countered by this ragtag group of idealistic misfits that have no idea really what they're saying and whether or not they're connecting with anybody, I feel. And so I think all of this is moot. I think there's no chance in hell anybody takes down Donald Trump. He's polling at 49%. When was the last time an incumbent president who was at 47 or better was beaten? I mean, it's impossible. I think there's no way this happens.
Well, I would direct you to Bill Galston's column from the Wall Street Journal, which we're carrying on Real Clear Politics this morning, which says, Democrats don't hit the panic button. And he talks about, you know, people were saying the same thing in February of you know, 1992, when George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, was running against Bill Clinton. And it looked like, you know, Clinton, everyone was like, who's this guy? He's a nobody from the South. And George H.W. Bush is a war hero. He's coming off the, you know, winning the Iraq, you know, first Iraq war, and approval ratings were high, and obviously they were heading into recession. So it was a bit of a different economic time, but things can change. And I mean, you know, if the economy goes south, I think that is Trump's ace in the hole. It's a reason that a lot of folks who don't like his style will still vote for him in the end. And if that goes away there, you know, he will be vulnerable, because I think he has, he does have these sort of stylistic, you know, issues with a lot of voters. He's not going to change. He's still out there tweeting about, you know, Joe Munchkin from West Virginia. it's just like he won. He won impeachment. He won acquittal. He could take the high road. It's right there for
him.
He's
his own worst enemy. He's self-destructive.
And instead, he decides to, you know, get after Mitt Romney and Joe Munchkin on Twitter, you know, nonstop. And that's the kind of stuff that turns some people off. His hardcore supporters love it, but for those folks in the middle who are like, I don't know, but I'm going to stick with him because of the economy.
I can't wait I hope Biden's not done yet, because I can't wait for him to do the Band of Brothers speech from Henry V in South Carolina. We happy few, we happy few. Tom Bevin, co-founder, president of RealClearPolitics.com. Tom Bevin, thanks so much for being here on the Chicago Way.
All right, guys. Thank you.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, Tom.
Yep. You got to learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold them. Know when to fold them. Know when to walk away. And know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting. We're here with Angelo Skip Saviano, the village president, or as we like to call him, the mayor of Elmwood Park, land of restaurants. Betty and I, my lovely Sicilian, wanted to live there years ago, but it didn't work out. How you doing, Mayor?
I'm doing great, John. I really appreciate you having me on the show. We're celebrating our third year of Restaurant Week for Elmwood Park. Elmwood Park is pretty much a bedroom community. The only major outlet I have is a Caputo's Market, which I guess is appropriate because we were the original location for Caputo's.
That's where I go to get my cheese and my good peaches from Michigan.
That's right. But so we focus here at Elmwood Park on our longstanding tradition of good restaurants.
Well, tell me about
so we celebrate that every February now with Restaurant Week, and all our restaurants give incentives to come into their place during that week. We've had a close relationship with our restaurants since I became mayor. We created a business district along North Avenue and Harlem Avenue to assist them in reinvesting in their restaurants. We were able to, right, about 4 years ago, I sent letters out to all the people who had houses along the alley behind Restaurant Row all the way down North Avenue. Since then, we've bought 7 of those houses to increase our parking capacity, and we've seen our revenues from those restaurants jump from 20 to 50% increases over the last 2 years. So it's been a great success, and these restaurants now have reinvested. You're familiar with the Restaurant Row. We have Russell's Barbecue on North and Thatcher, and you have Jim and Pete's, which did an $800,000 reinvestment a couple of years ago and expanded not only the restaurant, but their parking capacity. You go further east, you have the famous Armand's Pizza, which relocated off of Grand Avenue, came to North Avenue. Going east again, you have Alpine Food Shop, which has been there for 70-some years, famous little Italian deli.
You get the good kind of goal there at Alpine, Alpini? What do you get
Oh,
there?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do they have, like the supersides homemade? I can't wait.
Yes, all their fresh deli meats. They have homemade pastas, homemade pasta sauce that they make on site. In fact, they are so big. On Super Bowl Sunday, they do 3,000 sub sandwiches. And it's for a little place like that. I don't know how they do it. All I know is they have
the
free deliveries and get all the bread on that day.
It's the bread. When you have good bread, you're golden.
That makes the whole sandwich. And then you go further east from there, you have Johnny's Beef. Johnny's been there for over 50 years, and everybody knows Johnny's Beef. And that's a great anchor for Restaurant Row. You have Spizzico, which is an Italian restaurant. Then you have the famous New Star Chinese. They have reinvested in a hibachi room in the back where they do the live cooking there for you. Then you have Pepino's Italian. You have Massa Cafe, you have Cafe Cubano, you have Inari Japanese Sushi, and then going further east from there, you have Panera, and then you have Donnie G's. I'm sure you're familiar with Donnie Greco.
Yeah.
We used to own Adagio on Wheat Street and Miso on Grand and Ogden. Well, he bought a place on North Avenue. So that's our main drag on North Avenue, and we're excited that they're redeveloping North and Harlem, the Sears Center there. That's going to be 300 new units with a national grocer on the first floor. On our side, the old Sears Auto Center, we're putting another building there with 100 units with 17,000 square feet of retail on the first floor, and we're intending on putting restaurants there.
You have a big development coming in neighboring Melrose Park over at the racetrack. I guess Amazon's going to be there, right? You're going to have a lot of
restaurants. Yeah, they built three major facilities there for a distribution center for Amazon. So that's even more jobs. So we're going to have a lot more density of people along that whole main drag. And I'm also negotiating with a good friend of yours. I'm not going to say his name yet, to bring a Highline up Greek Taverna on 75th and North Avenue, which the village bought the building a couple of years ago, and we've been marketing it. And him and his group are interested in opening their fourth store. They have one in River North, one in Lincoln Park, and one in Wilmette.
Well, we'll see about that if they have the good Greek chicken. But when I go out with my wife, the Sicilian Betty, she wants Italian. And sometimes if you go to a funeral, okay, like a wake, I mean, I'm at Salerno's, right. There's a wake. Where do you go? Is it okay to go to Johnny's and get a beef hot dry after the funeral? Or should it be more like a sit down?
Well, if they're a wake or a funeral, you really should do a little finer dining than that. And it's a little bit more comforting to your soul when you're thinking about the person who you just lost. So
I'm not talking about the funeral luncheon. I'm talking about like I go to the wake, you know?
And, the wake the night before the funeral, of course.
The wake night before, but you have the tie on. I still wear a tie when I go out. I'm still old school. And then you got to do the lean. You know, that's the problem. When you have to do the lean for the Johnny's beef because it's so juicy, and I sometimes get a combo. And then I got
you don't want that juice on your tie. I know it's happened to me many times.
So, okay, it sounds like there's a lot going on in Elmwood Park. Yep.
Yeah, John, you know, after doing 20 years at Springfield, this has been a real honor to serve as the mayor of Elmwood Park. I've lived here all my life, and we're really progressing. We're reinvesting in our infrastructure. We've really come a long way and actually reinvented the town. We've got a lot of new families moving in. I see a lot of strollers on the street every day. We're expanding our park capacity.
Where's the Pancake House? Is the Pancake House still there?
On the River Forest side, Grandma Sally's.
That's River Forest. Yeah, okay, River Forest side of North Avenue.
Correct. That's the only restaurant on that side of the street in River Forest.
Really?
That's near North in Harlem.
That was a powerful breakfast place. That's all I'm going to say. How long? Way before you. How long have we known each other? What, 20, 30 years now?
Oh, at least.
You know?
At least.
All right, let me tell you.
Remember, my wife and I ran into you and your cousin Peter at the World Series on that Sunday. I remember it distinctly.
Oh, the White Sox, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was the White Sox series in 2005, right?
Yes. 2005, we were out on the concourse, I was showing around the park, and we ran into you and Peter. It was a nice afternoon.
It was good. I remember that was the series before with Boston, you know, when Sox beat the Red. There was a great game, and everyone piles out of Comiskey, or Sox Park, I call it. And who do I see right there? But Johnny, Billy and Rich Daly, and we all start hugging. We're like, while we're fighting, right? But everyone's hugging, and Maggie Daly's over on the side giving me the fish eye, you know, like, what do you mean? Why are you hugging that Cass over there? But yeah, that's how it is. What can I say?
It was a uniting effect with the White Sox. You know, you and I are big Sox fans, so, and we're excited about them this year. But I'm going to keep my powder dry until I see the season progress.
So where's Gene's Deli? I got to have Gene's Deli.
Gene's used to be on Harlem and Palmer. Since then, Gene's passed away, and they sold the property, and it's a condo building right now.
When I was a kid, I was telling you before you came on, I was just starting in the news. I was at college, and Dan Pompey, who's now in the Hall of Fame, is the sports writer. He was with the Tribune, Sun-Times, everybody. He's with the Athletic. He's just the greatest. A great guy, too. A real good guy. And he calls me up and says, I got a job for you. Elmwood Park, meet me at Gene's. That's all he said. So at, like, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock. So I show up, and there's like a bunch of guys sitting at a table. I'm like, what am I getting into here? And it was all the, it was a bunch of writers, you know, And and George Randazzo. And
he just passed away, George.
I know. And it was the Italian American Sports Hall of Fame newspaper. So I'm like, yeah, I'll write for this. This is awesome. So we had our first, we had the editorial board meeting there at Gene's while I'm meeting a sub at 9 o'clock in the morning. And the issue was, who do we put on the cover? It was always Mario Andretti, Joe Montana, or Phil Esposito, or Tony.
Right.
We always, I mean, it was an Italian American. What are you going to do? I'm not going to put a Greek basketball player on. You know.
Well, they did induct Franco Harris years ago because he was half Italian.
He's Italian. That's right.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
I'm thinking of the short Greeks that shouldn't be playing basketball. They should be playing soccer. Are the Maroons still there in Elmwood Park, or are they farther east?
No, the Maroons Club kind of dissipated. The Village, the TIF District, bought the property, and currently Dunkin' Donuts is redeveloping on that corner and taking in that lot. But the Maroons, a lot of those members moved to the Mazzini Verdi Club in Franklin Park on Belmont.
We're talking soccer here.
They're bocce.
Skip Saviano, Restaurant Week begins when in Elmwood Park?
February 21st, and it goes through the 28th.
I want everybody to go out there, go to Gene's. I mean, Gene's is no longer there. Go to Johnny's, have a beef, then walk around and think about what you're going to eat next, because there's a lot of good
stuff. That's right.
All right, thanks,
Skip. You got to get a hold of me, too. When you kind of come out here, I'll buy you lunch.
All right, buddy, I'll be out there. The Tribune will buy you lunch, Mayor Skip Saviano. That's how we roll in this. We don't put the velvet arm on anybody, even old friends. All right, I'll see you, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, Skip. That was Skip Saviano, Angelo Skip Saviano, Mayor of Elmwood Park, talking about Restaurant Week in Elmwood Park. I mean, how romantic is that? For Tom Bevan, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics, one of the great sites in journalism, and also the guy who once predicted on this show that Michelle Obama would come to the rescue. Not. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokan Show on WGN. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, nationally syndicated, and member of its editorial board. And news from us, you can catch us on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, find it, subscribe free, the Chicago Way. It's the only Chicago Way thing that won't cost you any money. It's free. See you next time.